Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety. And we've been thinking a lot about what motivates each of us to get involved, to try and make some kind of positive change in our own communities. We think it's got a lot to do with our own stories, what we've experienced, how we think of ourselves, who we are, what we value. So over the next several months, we want to meet people from all over the country who have stepped up in their immediate communities in some way. We want to hear their stories and learn how those stories propelled them to try something new, especially things that haven't quite worked out yet. As always, we want to hear from you. If you know someone we should meet, let us know. But tonight, I want you to meet Michael Tubbs. He was elected mayor of Stockton, California at 26 years old, making him the youngest mayor of a major U.S. city ever and the first Black mayor of Stockton. Everybody from Oprah to National Democratic Party operatives fawned over him. He was a Stanford graduate with this up-from-poverty personal story, a bright political future, and a record of trying out bold ideas in a city that has faced many economic challenges for many years. But then he lost his reelection by a lot. There were political postmortems, of course, but I think he tells the most interesting story himself. His memoir, published last fall, is called The Deeper Roots, a memoir of hope and home. And it's less about electoral politics than the life and the values that led him to even try politics in the first place, initially as a city council person and then as a mayor. The book was written before he lost, actually. So when he and I spoke, I asked him first about how he processed his unexpected defeat in the 2020 election.
That's a great question. And I think part of the difficulty was that I was so public and so so much of the processing was being done with everyone either being very excited I lost or mourning that I lost and all processing out loud. So there's a lot of noise and static. But what was helpful about particularly that loss was that it gave me a lot of clarity in terms of what I was willing to lose for. And just really kind of crystallized my focus on ending white supremacy, on ending poverty, and those are being things I'm willing to be ridiculed for or lose for.
We've been thinking a lot about how the things just feel so stuck politically at the national level. And then that makes us think about, you know, big, bold change at the local level instead. And I just wonder if you have key takeaways about your time trying to spur that kind of local revolution. You know, what do you think, or how do you think people should think about change at the local level?
When I look back at where Sheriff Stockton was when I started on city council, we were bankrupt and we led the nation in homicides per capita. By the time I left Stockton, we were, and not just because of me, but definitely had a large part in it, we had become the second most heavily fiscal city in the state. We had seen 40% reductions in homicides and shooting. We were the first city to pilot a basic income. We were doing all these things that seemed so impossible, particularly for Stockton. So, but I mean, it didn't come without struggle. It didn't come without cost. It didn't come without backlash, but it was possible and worth it. So that's what I want people to get, that it's not easy. It's not linear, but it is possible.
In your memoir, you are strikingly open for a public official about your life, despite the fact that you start the book with a quote from your mom saying, "Don't tell nobody our business," and you proceed to do just that. You share that your mother had you when she was just 16, I believe, and for most of your life, your father, who is also named Michael Tubbs, was incarcerated. Share a bit about your parents' story. How did they meet, and how did their crossed paths change the trajectory of each of their lives?
Yeah, my mom and my dad are both from Stockton, and they both sort of grew up, and I think it really speaks about sort of a social mobility, particularly for Black folks in this country, because they both grew up, like, at least lower middle class. Like, my grandmother worked for the county, worked at the post office and worked at the county as an eligibility worker for folks on welfare. So a government job, not rich, but solid. And my grandfather on my dad's side was one of the first Black firefighters for the Stockton Police Department. So solidly middle-class jobs. And my mom and dad met as teenagers at a roller skating rink. My mom ended up being pregnant at 16, didn't go to college, and ended up making less than her mother, which is the story of a lot of folks in this country, particularly Black folks, in terms of upward mobility.
Yeah.
And same with my father. He ended up being incarcerated and has been incarcerated since 95, but even before then was always in and out of jail. So their experiences actually gave me a lot of my policy focus in terms of opportunity, in terms of criminal justice reform, in terms of educational attainment. Like, I think it's just learning from their experiences and sort of growing up on the underside of this quote-unquote American dream has really made me the man I am, with empathy and with an understanding that the solution isn't found in individual attributes, but it's really in structural policy changes.
You also talk about, you know, this split between the life you created at Stanford and the reality of others in your family. You know, you talked about your cousin who was tragically shot and killed while you were interning for the Obama administration, this tension between trying to be leading a life where you are succeeding while holding your family at the same time. And I ask it because it's also, I struggle with the framing around this idea of, you know, those of us who make it need to go back and help those who didn't make it. There's something about that framing that's weird to me.
Yeah, I think my story, particularly in the book, but even in my life, is also one about the survivor's guilt. That's something that led me back to go back to Stockton, frankly. And something I still struggle with in terms of what's the line, what's the balance between being individually happy and being concerned about myself with these wider community concerns, particularly when other people who have similar jobs or similar roles don't have that extra responsibility. And I think that's what you're speaking to in terms of, like, the unfairness of it. But also, I think, just given the history, particularly of our people in this country, that we've always had to be communal in thinking. We've always had to sort of think about everyone else. But I also would say, you don't have to. I don't want people to feel pressured to do more than what they want to do. But I think if folks have that gumption, it's probably good to listen to that, because you might find a whole lot of lessons and a whole lot of blessings and things in that choice to go back and help. But I don't think it should be a requirement, nor do I think it's fair to assume it.
Yeah.
That, because you come from this, you have to work on that. Like, I don't think that's fair at all.
The first time you ever opened up about your family was your college admissions essay, which I think a lot of young people of color can identify with. It's really one of the only times for a lot of people where their struggle actually gives them a form of power. It's an interesting point about that. But,
honestly.
Know, right, you know. But you write that, and I'll quote it, "Storytelling, truth-telling is how we make sense of the world as it is and gain the vision and courage to create the world as it should be." Can you say more about that, just the power of storytelling?
So for me, I think storytelling is a way to get folks outside of their, like, ideological camps and, like, really center humanity. And it allows folks to kind of be disarmed enough to listen, take in, and understand other experiences from their own and find ways that there's commonality. mm-hmm. find ways that there are similarities that I think leads to more empathy. What I try to do in an office, but even more so out of office, is to use storytelling as a tool to get us to an understanding of sort of shared humanity that will lead to the policies I want to see, like paid leave or universal child care or basic income or baby bonds. Because I think the impediment for these policies is that the story we tell ourselves as a nation, or some people tell themselves, is that this nation was started by these people ordained by God to be smart and thrifty and hardworking. And they just work hard. And that's why they have so much. And that the folks who don't have anything, it's because they're lazy and they take mm-hmm. and they're dependent on government. And we know that's a false story. So what I tried to do with being brutally honest in my book, and even when I speak, is to let people know, like, no, here's a truer story of what it's like to be poor in this country and why people are poor in this country and actually how this country came to be. And I think through understanding that those stories, we create a policy landscape where the policies we want to see can happen.
We've talked about the sort of talking about your family, but you also talk about your own dramatic mistakes, you know, things like your DUI that you had to confront while you were a council member. And even this conversation about what led to your loss in 2020, why is that part of it important to include to you?
Well, the point of writing the book for me was because I grew up reading memoirs of folks that gave me a lot of courage and inspiration, like Man Child in the Promised Land, Makes Me Want to Holler, Black Boy, autobiography of Malcolm X, et cetera. And what I liked about those books were they were so honest. Like, it was real.
Right.
Very terrible scenes, very terrible choices. And you still love these characters. I thought, particularly as a political figure, it would be too easy. The easy route would be to paint this story of exceptionalism, paint this story of everything working perfectly, and paint this story of perpetual victory. Like, yes, it started hard, but now all I do is win. And I thought it was important to talk about the low moments, talk about being stupid 24-year-old getting a DUI and how difficult that was and how embarrassing that was and how I'm still paying for it almost a decade later, or talking about what does it mean to lose. I thought that was particularly important for the book because I think it gives, to what I said earlier, it just gives real credence and credibility to what I'm saying. Like, these mm-hmm. issues are issues I care about, win or lose.
During your mayoral term, you, as we've talked about, focused a lot on poverty. You became known for piloting a universal basic income program. You could have chosen a lot of things to build your public life around. Why was poverty the one that you thought this is really important to have to center in the conversation?
I think it's because of one, lived experience. But then number two, I think almost in a prophetic sense that I just don't see a path forward for our country with so much poverty. It's also a question of potential. Like, there's so much genius and potential locked into poverty. And it's something that's solvable. It's something that's man-made. It's mm-hmm. something we can fix.
You mentioned in answering that, you mentioned your lived experience as part of it. And we've implied some of this, but I want to be explicit about it. Can you say more about your own life in that regard?
Yeah, so grew up poor. My mom, she's a teenager. She was single with a child and eventually two kids. My father's been incarcerated my entire life. So spent 7 years on welfare. I spent time living in some of the worst neighborhoods in Stockton. At least we had, when I was mayor, we had a list of hot zones. There was like five of them. I had lived in every single one.
Yeah.
So like literally living sort of in a city with a lot of problems, but in a place in a city with a lot of problems where the problems were most concentrated. And what I saw there was not lazy people. I saw people working two or three jobs, people working incredibly hard, immigrants coming here for a new life. I saw children who at least started off liking school and wanting to do better in school, but the schools they went to were terrible. This is not things I studied at Stanford. These are things I lived. Mm. And I was lucky enough to go to Stanford, and now I'm just driven so that no one has experienced that type of stuff. Because again, it's avoidable. Like, it doesn't have to be this way.
You've said a couple times that your father was incarcerated most of your life. What's his story, and how has that shaped your choices?
Yeah, so I didn't realize the story about father's incarceration and how it really ties into everything I'm working on that we discussed until writing the book and doing research. But apparently he was arrested for robbing a rival gang member for money to pay for his daughter's funeral. And that story was really moved me for a couple of reasons. Number one, because he had been incarcerated for so long, I had assumed he had murdered somebody. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm a child of a murderer. What does that mean for me? And I had real guilt and intense anxiety about that as a young person. And then I recognized, like, wow, $3,000 cost this man 30 years of his life. $3,000. Because he didn't have enough money to bury his daughter. And in a time of great mourning and loss and trauma, made a terrible decision. And I think maybe that helps explain also why I'm so passionate about ending poverty. I don't want any father to be unable to bury their daughter. I don't want any father to lose 30 years of their life and of their child's life because they don't have money.
After Michael Tubbs lost his election and left public office, he created an initiative called End Poverty in California. And it's also a storytelling project, at least in part.
End Poverty in California is provocative in name on purpose because we are serious when we say in the fifth largest economy in the world with more billionaires than every country in the world besides the United States and China, we don't have to have poverty. We can end it in California. We have the tools to do so. The initiative is also about working with local leaders and working with leaders, period, on trying new approaches, trying new ideas, but really centering the conversation on why do we have so much poverty in a state with so much wealth, and why do we allow that? And I think part of naming it this is to be a provocation. Because I think every time someone says, how are you going to end poverty in California? I'm like, well, how are we going to sustain it? Like, there's two options here. It's either sustain poverty or end. Are you comfortable with sustaining it? How do you want to do that? If I want to do the opposite, right? So I think it's really, part of it is really to get people to think about, like, oh, wow, can we end poverty in California? Do I want to end poverty in California? Am I actually fine with poverty in California? A third of the state of California is in poverty or one paycheck away. That's a lot of people. We're not going to be the fifth largest economy in the world if we allow this to continue unabated. We are actually hypocrites in terms of our professed values, just given what we see in our communities. And we have to do something about it.
Michael Tubbs is special advisor to California Governor Gavin Newsom for economic mobility and is the founder of End Poverty in California. He's the former mayor of Stockton. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios. You can follow us wherever you get your podcast or check us out on WNYC's YouTube channel, where we also stream the show live each week. We're produced by Emily Botine, Regina Dahir, Karen Frillman, Kusha Navadar, Rahima Nassa, and Jared Paul. Matthew Mirando is our live engineer. And a special thanks to our intern, Katie Steele, who leaves us this week. We've loved having you, Katie. I'm Kai Wright, and you can find me on both Instagram and Twitter at Kai_Wright. Thanks for spending this time with us tonight, and I will talk to you next Sunday.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, Policing Equity and Voting Rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.